Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we're exploring a material that's, well, seemingly ordinary, but has played this absolutely extraordinary role in shaping civilizations. We're talking about limestone.
Yeah, it's everywhere, but maybe not always fully appreciated. We're going to look into, you know, what this rock actually is, its different forms, its key properties.
And really uncover how it's influenced, well, everything. How we've built our world, farmed the land, powered industry.
And even how we interact with the landscapes limestone itself creates, like those karst regions.
Exactly. You've got a stack of research here, and our goal is to connect the dots, pull out the really fascinating bits, and show its huge, often underestimated impact.
Okay, so limestone. Fundamentally, it's pretty simple stuff, right? Mostly calcium carbonate.
Yeah, calcite. Or sometimes it's got magnesium carbonate mixed in, and then it's called dolomite.
But from that basic recipe, you get this amazing variety of forms. It mostly forms in warm, shallow seas.
From the buildup of marine life, you mean?
Right.
Like shells, coral, tiny organisms.
Precisely. That's the biogenic route. Or it can precipitate directly out of the water chemically.
Wild to think these massive rock formations started like that.
It really is. And then impurities, a bit of silica, some clay, shale, they can really change the rock's final character.
Which leads to all the different types we hear about.
Uh-huh. Like oolitic limestone, it's made of these tiny spheres called oids, all cemented together.
Which makes it really uniform, apparently. Easy to work with.
Exactly. Very consistent texture, easy to machine. Okay. So it's great for detailed carvings, but also for things like, you know, needing lots of identical blocks for a big project.
Like the pyramids, maybe?
Potentially, yeah. That consistency would have been a huge advantage. Then there's dolomitic limestone or dolus stone.
That's the one with magnesium and fossils often. Gives it interesting textures, I bet.
It does, and that magnesium can make it tougher, more resistant to freezing and thawing. It even affects how it reflects sunlight.
Interesting. Okay, what else? Coquina.
Ah, coquina. That's basically loosely cemented shells. Pretty coarse stuff.
So, more porous, I guess. Maybe a bit rougher looking.
Yeah, definitely more porous. Gives it a different kind of aesthetic, maybe more rustic.
Then chalcarite sounds like sandy limestone.
Pretty much. Sand-sized grains of calcite, tiny fossils, shell bits. Oolitic limestone is actually a type of chalcarenite if it's mostly oids.
Okay. And micrite. Microcrystalline limestone.
That's super fine grain. Formed from consolidated lime mud, you can barely see the individual crystals.
Right. And travertine. That's the one from springs.
Yes. Deposited from groundwater, often around mineral springs. It's usually light-colored, often porous or banded. The Roman Colosseum is a famous example, built largely of travertine.
Wow. Okay. So physically, it's generally softer than, say, granite. Yeah. Often gray, but can be white, yellow, brown. Texture and porosity vary a lot.
Uh-huh. And chemically, this is where it gets really interesting. It's reaction with acid.
That's the classic test, isn't it? It fizzes.
It does. Calcium carbonate reacts with acid and releases carbon dioxide gas, effervescence. With strong acid, it's quite vigorous, even gives off heat.
But generally, it doesn't react much otherwise. And it's not flammable.
Generally, no. Though it has some odd incompatibilities. Apparently, it can ignite on contact with fluorine gas, which is surprising.
Huh. Weird. But the key chemical thing is calcination, right? Heating it up.
Absolutely fundamental. Heat limestone to around 825 degrees Celsius or higher, and it decomposes.
Into quicklime, calcium oxide, and carbon dioxide.
KCO3 plus heat gives you CaO plus CO2. That quicklime is the starting point for so much.
And then you add water to quicklime slaking and get slaked lime calcium hydroxide.
Right, another really useful product. But that same reactivity with acid, that's also its weakness.
Acid rain.
Exactly. Even normal rain is slightly acidic. Over time, it dissolves limestone structures. It's this constant battle for preservation.
So useful for making stuff, but vulnerable once it's built into stuff. A real double-edged sword.
Precisely. And this rock is found all over the globe. It often forms aquifers holding groundwater and can trap oil and gas, too. Think of the Nile Valley cliffs in Egypt, massive limestone formations.
Its sheer availability must be why it's been used so much throughout history.
Availability, combined with its properties, durable enough to last, workable enough to shape, aesthetically pleasing,
and chemically useful when needed. It makes sense it became a foundational building material.
Absolutely. Look at ancient Egypt. The pyramids, the Great Pyramid alone, used something like 2.3 million limestone blocks.
Incredible scale.
Yeah.
And the Sphinx, carved directly from an outcrop. They even quarried specific high-quality limestone, like from Tura.
They used it for everything, massive structures, intricate release inside tombs, statues, sarcophagi. Its workability was key.
Then you jump to the Mayan civilization.
Uh-huh.
Places like Palenque, Tikal, pyramid temples, palaces, all from local limestone.
And crucially, they developed burnt lime cement from limestone that was essential for their mortar and for the stucco they used to cover and decorate buildings.
So not just the blocks, but the glue holding it together and the canvas for their art.
Exactly. That lime cement allowed for more complex, durable architecture, step pyramids, corbelled vaults, those intricate carvings and masks.
And the Romans. They were huge users, too, especially where marble was scarce.
Definitely. The Colosseum, mostly travertine. But their big innovation was that lime ash cement, the pozzolanic stuff, around 300 BCE.
That hydraulic cement hardened underwater.
A total game changer. It enabled them to build durable aqueducts, harbors, roads, baths, infrastructure on an unprecedented scale. It was stronger and more versatile than anything before.
What about the Greeks?
They used limestone extensively early on, especially since it was readily available and easy to work, often coated with stucco.
But they famously shifted to marble later for the big, prestigious projects like the Parthenon.
Right. Marble offered a different aesthetic, maybe a symbol of wealth and status in the classical period. But limestone remained fundamental for everyday construction.
Fast forward to medieval Europe. Cathedrals, castles. Limestone everywhere.
Dominant material, both for the structure and for elaborate sculpture. Saints, gargoyles, biblical scenes. The quality of the local stone really dictated what was possible architecturally.
The research mentions specific types from France, like Banque Royale, being transported far and wide.
Yeah, high-quality stone was valuable. In places without good local limestone, like parts of medieval Ireland, they used other methods like dry stone masonry or even imported stone. Science like neutron activation analysis can now help trace where medieval stone came from, which is fascinating for understanding trade.
Wow, and it shaped whole cities. Paris, for example. That distinctive, creamy look.
Comes from the massive use of local Lutetian limestone during the Haussmann renovations in the 19th century. It creates this incredible visual harmony. So many landmarks use it. Parts of Notre Dame, the Louvre, Sacré-Cœur.
It really defines the city's character.
It does. It's the genius loci, the spirit of the place, captured in stone.
And here in the U.S., Indiana limestone. America's original building stone.
That's the one. Incredibly popular. Think of the Empire State Building, the Pentagon, Lincoln Memorial, Washington National Cathedral, loads of state capitals and universities.
Why was it so popular?
Durability, workability, but also its consistency. It has a very uniform grain and color range buffs, grays, which suited both classical and modern styles for large-scale projects.
And it's still used today, right? Not just the historical material.
Oh, absolutely. Still popular for cladding, flooring, paving, decorative elements, even structural walls and foundations in modern buildings. It just has this timeless appeal.
But it does have its issues.
Yeah.
Weathering, staining.
Crumbling, chipping. And that vulnerability to acid we talked about, it dissolves, loses detail. Conservation is a constant challenge for limestone structures.
Needs careful work to preserve it.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Specialized techniques are needed to deal with everything from erosion and staining to salt damage like efflorescence.
Oh. Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roach Bosch Hannah.
Roach Bosch Hannah. Ah, oh, perfect timing.
Oh, that smells wonderful today, Hannah. Is that the one with extra ginger? It seems particularly zesty.
Mmm, it does smell good. Let's see. Mmm, it's lovely and warm. Maybe just a touch on the bitter side today. Could perhaps use a tiny bit more sugar. What do you think?
You know, I think you might be right. Just a hint of bitterness on the finish. A little sweetness would balance it nicely. Still delicious, though, Hannah. Thanks so much.
Yes, thank you. Okay. Quick chai break, then.
Perfect. Short chai break. Oh, much needed. Okay, back to limestone. Let's shift gears to agriculture. I wouldn't normally connect rocks and farming so directly.
Well, limestone plays a surprisingly vital role, primarily in managing soil acidity. Many soils are naturally acidic or become acidic through farming practices like using nitrogen fertilizers or just harvesting crops, which removes nutrients.
And acidity is bad for crops.
It can be, yeah. Below a certain pH, essential nutrients like phosphorus become less available to plants. Worse, toxic elements like aluminum and manganese can become soluble and harm root growth, especially below pH 5.5 for aluminum.
Okay, so how does limestone help? They use a glime.
Exactly. A glime is just pulverized limestone, either calcitic or dolomitic. When you add it to acidic soil, the carbonate in the limestone reacts with the excess hydrogen ions, the source of the acidity.
It neutralizes it.
Yeah.
Like an antacid for the soil.
That's a perfect analogy. It raises the soil pH, making it less acidic. This reaction also helps by precipitating that soluble aluminum out as harmless aluminum hydroxide.
So, better pH, fewer toxins. What else?
Well, it supplies essential nutrients itself, calcium, obviously, and magnesium if you use dolomitic lime. It makes other nutrients, like phosphorus, more available.
Oh, right. Unlocks them from the acidic conditions.
Precisely. And it improves the environment for beneficial soil microbes, including those involved in nitrogen fixation for legumes. Better soil structure, better water use. It's a whole cascade of benefits.
Reduces toxicity, improves fertilizer efficiency. It sounds like a huge boost for crop yields.
It really is. And what's fascinating is that farmers figured this out empirically centuries ago. This widespread use of lime is like early human geochemical engineering.
Just through observation and trial and error? Amazing. It must have fundamentally changed agriculture and where people could successfully farm.
Absolutely. It allowed for higher productivity, supported larger populations, and they even understood nuances like the importance of the limestone's purity, its calcium carbonate equivalence, or CCE.
And the fineness of the grind. Finer works faster, coarser lasts longer.
Exactly. Finding the right balance. And knowing it needs moisture and time to work, often applying it well before planting, it's quite sophisticated when you think about it.
Okay, so it sustains agriculture. What about powering industrial progress? This seems like a big one.
Huge. And again, it often comes back to that chemical transformation through heat calcination, turning limestone KCO3 into quicklime, CaO.
That quicklime seems key.
It's the gateway product, heating limestone in a kiln, driving off the CO2. That quicklime can then be slaked with water to make slaked lime, KOH2. Both are industrial workhorses.
But the really big one is cement, isn't it?
Indispensable. Limestone is the primary raw material for Portland cement, the binder in concrete, mortar, stucco.
How does that work?
You crush limestone and mix it with clay, sand, iron ore, then heat it to super high temperatures, like 1450 degrees Celsius, in a rotary kiln.
That creates cement clinker.
Right. Complex chemical reactions happen, forming calcium silicates and aluminates. The limestone provides the essential calcium oxide for these reactions. Then you cool the clinker, grind it finely, and add a bit of gypsum to control setting time.
And sometimes finely ground limestone is added back in as a filler.
Yes, it can improve the quality, strength, and workability of the final cement. It's this progression direct use like in Egypt, then lime mortar, then the Roman cement innovations, leading to modern Portland cement that enabled so much of our built world.
Stronger, moldable materials, allowing new architectural forms.
Domes, arches, massive infrastructure, a true technological leap based on understanding limestone's chemistry.
What about in metal production? Smelting.
Limestone acts as a flux, especially making iron and steel. In the blast furnace, it decomposes to quicklime.
The calcium oxide again.
Uh-huh. And that basic calcium oxide reacts with acidic impurities in the ore, like silica and phosphorus compounds.
To form slag.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Molten slag, mostly calcium silicate, which is less dense than the iron, floats on top and can be easily removed. It purifies the metal and also helps lower the melting point.
Clever. And glass. You mentioned that earlier.
Essential ingredient. Again, the calcium oxide from limestone acts as a flux, lowering the melting point of silica, which saves a lot of energy. It also adds durability and chemical stability to the glass.
Paper manufacturing, too.
Yep. Finely ground calcium carbonate, or GCC,
what?
And precipitated calcium carbonate, PCC, are used widely as fillers and coating pigments.
As filler, it goes into the pulp.
Right. Fills the gaps between cellulose fibers, makes the paper brighter, more opaque, smoother, better for printing.
And as a coating.
Applied to the surface to improve whiteness, gloss, and how well it takes ink. Really important for high-quality paper.
The list just keeps going. Chemicals, pharmaceuticals.
Filler and tablets, calcium supplements, antacids.
Paints, plastics, rubber.
Filler and extender in paints for opacity. Filler in plastics and rubber for strength and stability.
Water treatment.
Neutralizes acidic water, removes impurities.
Air pollution control.
Lime, derived from limestone, is crucial for flue gas desulfurization, removing sulfur dioxide from power plant emissions to reduce acid rain.
And even soil stabilization for construction.
Lime improves the engineering properties of soils for building roads and foundations. It's just incredibly versatile.
But all this usefulness means we dig up enormous amounts of it, quarrying, which brings economic benefits but also environmental costs, right?
Absolutely. It's a classic resource dilemma. Quarrying provides jobs, stimulates local economies, contributes to GDP, sometimes spurs infrastructure like roads.
Yeah.
These are real benefits, especially in rural areas. But there are significant drawbacks. Rehabilitating quarried land is expensive. The jobs and revenue are temporary. They only last as long as the rock does. Communities can become overly dependent.
And the environmental impact can hurt other industries, like tourism.
Potentially, yes. If the visual impact, dust, or noise pollution is severe, the full life cycle costs, including long-term remediation and helping communities transition afterwards, aren't always factored in up front.
So what are the main environmental impacts we're talking about?
Well, landscape alteration is huge. Massive pits, piles of waste rock. It's a permanent change, visually disruptive, and destroys habitats.
Loss of biodiversity.
Definitely. Removing vegetation and topsoil displaces wildlife, fragments ecosystems. Then there's air pollution dust from blasting, crushing, transport.
Which can cause health problems like silicosis if there's silica in the rock and harms plants.
Right. And greenhouse gas emissions from all the heavy machinery and transport, plus the energy used in processing, like calcination for lime.
Noise pollution, too, from blasting and equipment.
A major issue for nearby communities and wildlife. And water pollution is a big concern.
Runoff carrying sediment and potentially chemicals.
Exactly. Into streams, rivers, groundwater. It can contaminate water sources, harm aquatic life. It can even alter local groundwater levels.
Plus, soil erosion from the disturbed land and managing the sheer volume of quarry waste.
It all adds up. Significant environmental challenges.
And the social impacts on communities. Displacement, health hazards from dust and noise, disruption of traditional livelihoods.
Increased traffic, strain on local roads. It can be very disruptive. That's why mitigation is crucial. Environmental assessments, careful planning, dust suppression, noise control, waste management, and importantly, effective land reclamation after closure.
Turning old quarries into something useful, like parks or lakes.
Exactly. But it requires planning and investment.
Okay, let's talk about those landscapes. Limestone creates karst,
yeah,
where the rock's solubility shapes everything.
Right. These landscapes, formed by water dissolving the limestone, present a unique mix of resources and risks for human settlement.
How does it actually happen? Just rainwater dissolving the rock?
Basically, yes. Rainwater picks up CO2 from the air and soil, becoming mildly acidic carbonic acid. This water seeps into cracks and joints in the limestone and slowly dissolves it,
creating sinkholes, caves, underground rivers.
All the classic karst features. Sinkholes, or dolines, form by dissolution or collapse. Caves form along underground drainage paths. Springs emerge where that water comes back to the surface. Sometimes streams just disappear underground, sinking streams.
And that weathered zone near the surface, the epikarst.
Very important. It's like a sponge channeling water down into the deeper system.
Karst aquifers are major water sources, you said.
Hugely important globally. Some of the most productive aquifers. They store and transmit vast amounts of groundwater through networks of conduits and caves. About a quarter of the world's population relies on them to some extent.
But they're vulnerable. Water flows fast with little filtering.
That's the critical issue. Rapid recharge through sinkholes and fissures means pollutants from farming, industry, sewage can travel quickly and contaminate large areas of the aquifer with minimal natural cleanup. What happens on the surface directly impacts the water below,
making water management really tricky.
Very. You have to think about the whole catchment area, including where the underground drainage goes, which might not match the surface topography at all.
And farming in karst areas. Sounds tough.
Amen to karst.
Paradox. It's a paradox.
Mm-hmm.
You can have high rainfall, but the water drains away so quickly underground that the surface soil stays dry. Plus, soils are often thin, patchy, and not very fertile.
Rocky terrain, too, making cultivation difficult.
Yes. Exposed bedrock is common. It limits arable land. In extreme cases, erosion can lead to rocky desertification. Getting water for irrigation can also be hard, despite the groundwater beneath.
Yet people adapt. How?
Through really ingenious strategies. Water-saving techniques like mulching and conservation tillage, terracing slopes to control erosion, using the bottoms of sinkholes where soil and moisture collect.
Building ponds, harvesting rainwater.
Exactly. Adapting practices to the specific challenges of the landscape.
And settlement patterns, mostly around springs. Historically, yes, reliable water was key. Caves provided early shelter. The rugged, dry interiors were often more sparsely populated, maybe used for grazing.
But karst areas can also be biodiversity hotspots.
They can, with varied habitats. And they have hazards too, most notably sinkholes.
Which can form slowly or collapse suddenly?
Right. The collapsed sinkholes are the dangerous ones. They can be triggered naturally by heavy rain or earthquakes or by human activity.
Like pumping out groundwater or heavy construction?
Yes. Altering the water table or overloading the surface can trigger collapse. They can cause immense damage. Add to that risks of gradual subsidence, flooding and depressions, and that ever-present groundwater contamination risk.
So limestone isn't just rock. It's tied up with culture, symbolism, even spirit.
Deeply. Its physical properties, workability for art, the unique karst landforms provided a canvas for human belief systems, social structures, identity.
Its use in art goes way back. Egypt, the Maya, Greece. Its softness allowed for detailed sculpture.
Precisely. The Great Sphinx, Mayan temple carvings with glyphs and serpent masks, early Greek statues. Limestone was often the medium of choice, especially before marble became dominant in some areas. Even medieval cathedrals are covered in limestone figures.
And it came to symbolize things. Strength, permanence.
Definitely. Building monuments like the pyramids or the Lincoln Memorial out of limestone imbues the material itself with a sense of endurance, resilience, the lasting power of the values they represent, fortifications too.
And using local stone connects people to their place. That Parisian limestone again, or Indiana limestone in the U.S.?
It fosters a sense of regional identity, a connection to the Tagore, if you will, but for stone.
And the karst features themselves, caves, springs often became sacred sites.
Hugely significant, especially in cultures like the Maya. Caves were seen as portals, homes of gods and ancestors, central to rituals. Cenotes, those water-filled sinkholes, were also vital religious sites.
And this wasn't just the Maya, right?
No, it's widespread. Caves used as shrines in Minoan Crete, sacred springs like Lourdes. Indigenous cultures worldwide often have deep connections to these features, seeing them as places of origin, ceremony, or life-giving power.
Maybe that spiritual significance helped protect these fragile water sources.
It's quite possible. Reverence for cave spirits or water deities might have functioned as a form of traditional conservation ethic, born from a deep understanding of their ecological importance for survival.
Folklore, too. Strange rock formations inspiring myths, those petrosomatoglyphs, footprints or handprints in the rock.
Yes, natural or carved marks interpreted as signs left by deities, saints, heroes, or kings, used in ceremonies like crowning a king on an ancestral footprint. Irish folklore is rich with tales linked to limestone areas like the Burren or the Walk of Cashel.
It's like the stone itself holds stories and memories.
Exactly. It becomes part of the cultural landscape, not just the physical one.
So wrapping this all up, limestone's influence is just immense. Geology, architecture, agriculture, industry, the landscapes we inhabit, our culture.
It's woven through almost every aspect of human history and development. And it's not just a passive backdrop. Its specific properties, its availability, the landscapes it forms, they actively shaped opportunities and constraints for civilizations.
A real co-evolution between humans and this rock.
I think that's a good way to put it. And looking forward, our relationship with limestone continues to evolve. From simply using it, to processing it chemically, now to managing the impacts of extracting it on a massive scale and living with its geological quirks like karst.
Which means sustainability and stewardship are key now.
Absolutely. More sustainable quarrying, effective land reclamation, responsible management of those vulnerable karst water systems, and preserving the vast architectural and cultural heritage built from limestone.
It's an incredible legacy, a profound symbiosis, really.
And with our growing capacity to use and alter the planet comes that growing responsibility to manage resources like limestone wisely.
The story of limestone, then, is etched into the fabric of civilization. From ancient wonders to the concrete and chemicals of today, it's been this quiet but incredibly powerful force.
We hope exploring this has given you a new lens through which to see the world, a new appreciation for this common yet uncommon stone.
Maybe look around your own environment. What structures tell a limestone story? And thinking about the future, how do we maintain our relationship with this vital resource sustainably? Something to ponder.
Thank you for joining us on the Curtis Research Audio Archive. We look forward to our next exploration together.